Welcome back to Class Act, Updates in Education Law. I'm Miriam.
I am still not Lisa.
This is Christina. Miriam and Christina, we are attorneys at Walter Haverfield. We practice education law, and often we get together, we talk about the latest legal developments in education that are relevant to school boards, administrators, teachers, anybody who works with kids in the schools. Today, we're going to be talking about mistakes.
Mistakes. It's a great topic. Mistakes happen all the time. Sometimes mistakes are something that arises just out of an honest-to-goodness error, right? Everybody's human. We all have issues.
All make mistakes.
Everybody makes mistakes. Sometimes mistakes aren't really so much mistakes as much as they are willful neglect of what somebody should be doing.
Yep. So
there's two different kinds of mistakes that we're going to be talking about, you know, like little oopsies and then bigger things where people just really are truly not doing what they need to do. As a school district, however, the important piece to think about and know is, how are you going to respond to the mistake, right? There are lots of different ways to respond to mistakes. Sometimes the question is, oh my gosh, do we just kind of sweep it under the rug and hope nobody notices?
No.
Do we go ahead and be upfront and offer to compensate people and make things right?
Yes.
But then the other piece of that is, well, what do we do with the employee or employees, plural, who made the mistakes? And
right.
Part of that often depends on, well, was the mistake one of, oops, I just made a mistake because I'm human and that happens,
right.
Or was it a more willful neglect when someone who is intentionally, you know, not following policy, not following an IEP,
ignoring,
you know,
sloppy,
ignoring things that they need to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we have mistakes that involve like falsification of data,
yep.
You know, things of that nature. So those are certainly much more challenging mistakes to deal with because you have to deal with those on multiple levels. So you have the level of how do I work through it and make it right for a student if there was a student involved, and then how do I deal with it from a disciplinary angle, perhaps, from that school employee who really should have known better than engaging in the conduct that they engaged in.
And I also want to say at this point that longtime listeners probably remember that we did a series on investigations. And it was in the beginning of season 2. It was called Hanky Panky in the Classroom. And it was a 3-part series on how to investigate employee misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to touch a little bit about on investigations today. But if you wanted a more thorough review of that topic, you could go to the beginning of season 2 and listen to all of those 3 episodes. And if you are wondering where you can get this other than your standard podcast platform, you can also look at our website, walterhave.com/podcasts, and that will bring you to the entire treasury trove of our education law podcast, where you can look up season 2, Hanky Panky in the Classroom. But anyway, so let's get back to talking about mistakes.
Right. So we just talked about there are a couple different kinds of mistakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are the ones that are just oopsies. There are the ones that are really poor judgment. So
right.
What factors do districts need to look at in terms of how they deal with these mistakes, just kind of as an overview?
I think that, you know, like you were saying, the initial response is key. The way a district administrator responds when he or she finds out that one of their staff members, one of their employees, has made an error is really critical. It's important that it be fast and that it be comprehensive. Another issue to always keep in mind is union issues. So you're going to want to not push those aside and deal with it later, but you're going to want to be aware of your collective bargaining agreement and the union, making sure that the union representatives are an integral part of your process.
And I want to stop you right there really quickly just to say I can't stress enough how important it is that if you have a teacher who is governed by a collective bargaining agreement, you know, your teachers are unionized, how important it is to make sure that you are following that agreement to the letter and you're giving the teacher all of the rights that they're entitled to under that agreement, including the right to union representation at any meeting where discipline might flow from that meeting.
Yeah, that's important.
And I say that because you don't want to find yourself in a situation where a teacher has engaged in really egregious misconduct and then you're not in a position to discipline because
right.
we haven't followed all of the steps that are outlined for the teacher's protection under the collective bargaining agreement. So no matter how bad the misconduct is, if we haven't followed the collective bargaining agreement, we're going to be severely compromised in how we handle that from an employee discipline perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, prevention is also key. So I think, you know, these scenarios that we'll be talking about now, in each of these scenarios, the district learned something for how to prevent this in the future. So that'll be something important for you to hear. Even if your district has not encountered this particular situation, you'll hear about how other districts are working to prevent it in the future.
So we want to share with you some scenarios. I will share with you that all of these are scenarios that Miriam and I have faced in the course of our practice. Names, titles, identifying characteristics have been changed to protect the not so innocent in these scenarios. But these are real life examples, if you will. So the first one, we have a parent who is complaining that her child's speech language pathologist has failed to provide the services to the student as required in the child's IEP, and that as a result, the student is not making very much progress. So the speech language pathologist has records that are unclear. They are just really a mess. So when the director confronts the speech language pathologist, the speech language pathologist is like, no, everything's fine. Don't
just
worry about
it.
This kid's not making progress because she's just lazy. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. And director of special education says, okay, so I hear you, as she's thinking in the back of her head, I don't believe you, but I hear you. Mm. So what I want to see from you, speech language pathologist, is all of your data.
All the raw data.
Right? So show me the data and show me how it correlates back to the progress reports, because you've issued progress reports to this parent that show the child is actually making progress, right? Interestingly, when the district gets a hold of the data, the special education director starts to go through the data and recognizes that there are a lot of problems with it. It doesn't line up to the IEP goals, things are not matching up, and oh, by the way, data is recorded on days that school was not even in session, right?
Oops.
So the district was out for some snow days, and the speech language pathologist had put in data for those days. And the lesson that this really should teach you is that if you're going to go back and falsify all of your data, you should really check the calendar and make sure that school was in session on all of the days that you're recording data for.
Or don't falsify data.
Or just don't falsify
data, right?
That would be the real lesson in this. But if you're going to do it, you've got to do a better job than what this person did, because it was just bad.
Yeah.
So the steps that the district took, right, in dealing with this situation, they did a really good job. They interviewed the parent. They asked for more information. They looked at the progress reports. They got all of this information, all of this data. And when they realized what was happening, especially when they saw the data that, didn't line up, they decided to go back to the speech language pathologist and ask for all of the data, right? So I don't just want to see the data for this student. I want to see the data for all of the students on your caseload.
Mm-hmm.
Because now that I've uncovered this problem, I think I might uncover more.
Right.
And sure enough, they did. What they learned was that the problem was very, very widespread, and it was not just an isolated incident or oops, I wrote something down on a day that I shouldn't have or something like that. The outcome in this situation was that the speech language pathologist ultimately resigned her position.
Mm-hmm.
She decided that
was better
than fighting termination. She tried to argue that she just didn't really know how to collect data. But the district had done an excellent job. The director of special education had done all of these in-services on how to collect data and had demonstrated that this SLP was at those in-services.
Right.
So when we showed all that to the union and said, look, you can't possibly say that you didn't know what to do. You got training on this.
Right.
So that was another key point in the outcome.
Document everything. You know, have training sessions and document who shows up at those sessions.
That's exactly right. So in terms of what the district did for the students involved, the district fessed up, if you will, to all the parents. You know, we talked about, do you sweep it under the rug or do you fess up?
Don't sweep it under the rug. Spoiler alert.
The district talked to all the parents. They said, this is the issue that we have, and we are going to offer your son or daughter compensatory education, you know, compensatory speech services for time that we think that maybe they didn't get all of the services that were required by their IEP. Some parents took advantage of that, other parents didn't, but the district made the offer to all of the students who were impacted.
Yeah, so that story has a happy ending, and I really credit that district for providing the training and documenting her attendance, everybody's attendance at that training.
That was really key.
Yeah, that's key. So another case that I thought was interesting, something that, you know, probably does happen more often than we'd like to think about, is a teacher was dealing with a high-maintenance parent, and decided to complain to her friend at the grocery store. And she used the child's name, the parent's name, and a lot of details. And lo and behold, they were not the only people in that grocery store. There were other people, including a friend of this parent's. And the parent's friend heard this whole thing and then called the district, went to the district administrator and complained, you know, rightfully so, hearing all of this relatively confidential information at the grocery store. The district took some immediate steps, interviewed the friend who had made the complaint, interviewed the teacher in accordance with the bargaining agreement. A union representative was there for that interview. The teacher at that point did admit to poor judgment, which I think is an understatement.
That might be an understatement.
That might
of the
be
situation,
an understatement.
But yes.
But
at least the teacher admitted
right,
it.
Right, right. And then the district ended up disciplining the teacher according to the collective bargaining agreement, apologized to the parent, and then moved that child to another classroom. You know, essentially, I think the takeaways here was that the apology and the remedy avoided a complaint about confidentiality. The parent had other options. She could have filed a complaint, you know, with the Family Policy Compliance Office or with other agencies, and the district was able to avoid all of that, the complaint and the investigation. And the district was careful in that it involved the union and knew about the collective bargaining agreement and its requirements. I think that was key as well.
So our next situation deals with a transgender student and a teacher refusing to call the transgender student by the student's preferred name. So this was a high school student who was transgender who said, "I would prefer to be called by this name." The student had the full support of the parents, met with building administrators and school counselors, and everybody was on board with calling the student by the preferred name, with the exception of this one teacher.
Music teacher.
Yes. And the music teacher, I think, made it a point, to be honest with you, to call the student by the non-preferred name as often as she possibly could. She was very offended by the student's status as a transgender individual. She said that it conflicted with her own sincerely held religious beliefs and that she couldn't possibly call the student by the student's non-preferred name that didn't, you know, conform to the student's gender that was assigned at birth.
Right.
So the district essentially said, look, you need to get on board with this. You know, everybody else in the building is on board with this and they're calling the student's preferred name. And this is not impacting your ability to practice your religion. I'm not doing anything to interfere with your ability to practice your religion. Right. I am saying to you that you need to call the student by their preferred name. So the building administrator met with the music teacher, laid all this out, explained everything, and said, not just I'm asking you,
I'm
and this
you
is
a
important,
direction, yeah.
I am directing you. Yeah. I am directing you to call the student by their preferred name. And the music teacher failed to comply with that directive. And in fact, repeatedly failed to comply with that directive. At the end of the day, the student ended up leaving that particular class because it certainly was not working out. This happened toward the end of the school year. Okay. Because the teacher had failed to follow the directive, the district was in a really good position to discipline the teacher per the collective bargaining agreement for insubordination. So it's also important to know that the building administrator didn't just tell the teacher this directive. Okay. The building administrator also put it in writing. You know, so after the first discussion where they had the verbal directive, when that didn't work, the building administrator said, okay, I'm going to meet with the teacher again, and this time I'm going to give you something in writing that says what I am directing you to do. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put in that writing that your failure to do this could be considered insubordination, and it could lead to discipline up to and including termination of your employment. Right. So all of that was in the written directive that went to the teacher. The teacher failed to do that. And the district proceeded down the path of discipline, and eventually this was a teacher who ended up resigning.
One important point that I'd like to make is to call your attorney when anything relates to not only, you know, transgender issues, because those are evolving and may differ by your particular location, even by your particular county, but also to call counsel when it relates to First Amendment issues. So this is a teacher who was alleging that her religious faith was being affected, and because that's a First Amendment issue, just like free speech is a First Amendment issue, we would always urge you to contact contact your attorney. And that's because with the First Amendment, even the slightest change in facts can alter the outcome of the legal analysis. So if you have any religious issues or free speech issues that are coming up in the context of a insubordinate staff member, definitely reach out to counsel to make them aware of that and let them know all the facts in detail.
And also be aware that transgender issues and the rights of transgender individuals is an area that continues to evolve within law. Mm-hmm. And because the United States Supreme Court has not yet heard a transgender case, different circuits across the country, different circuit courts of appeals are going to look at those cases and have looked at those cases differently. So depending on what circuit your district is located in, you might have some different law that governs you. Mm-hmm. Additionally, some municipalities have adopted laws related to transgender individuals. So not necessarily a state law, but you know, a local ordinance, a local law that could impact you. So you need to be very, very careful when dealing with transgender issues.
Thank you. Another case that I wanted to bring up is where we had a district where there was an intervention specialist who was holding IEP meetings all by herself.
Can you really call it an IEP meeting if you're all by yourself?
Right. So instead of having an IEP team come to these meetings and make decisions, this individual took it upon herself to just have the meeting with the parent, and she thought that was going to be, you know, faster and less complicated. Just to go ahead and meet an annual review with the parent, and then later on she would ask other teachers to sign off that they attended, which of course they did not. So
there's so many problems with this scenario, right? and the thing that makes this particular teacher's conduct, I think, particularly egregious is the fact that she kept going back to one particular brand new teacher and saying to that teacher, hey, can you sign off on this IEP to say that you are at this meeting, right? So this was a teacher who had been in the district for a very long time, and she truly took advantage of her much less experienced colleague in getting someone to try to help, you know, kind of cover up her mistakes, if you will. So the district investigated this. They interviewed the intervention specialist. They interviewed the teacher who was the most frequent signer, if you will, of these IEPs.
The new teacher.
The new teacher, right? So the new teacher was just horrified when she found out that this was really not okay, because the veteran teacher had said to her, oh, don't worry about it. You have the student in class. It's not a big deal.
This
so it's
done.
Fine
yeah.
for you to sign yeah. off. Don't you even worry your little head about it for a minute. So both of these teachers engaged in misconduct. Obviously, the veteran teacher's conduct was far worse.
Right.
You know, for the new teacher, I think she was given a written reprimand or something along those lines, or it might have just been a verbal reprimand. I think the superintendent, frankly, took pity on her because he's like, you know, I really feel like you got the wool pulled over your eyes by your more experienced colleague, and I can see who the truly bad actor was in this situation. Importantly, the veteran teacher, who is responsible for this, she tried to go back and blame other people, right? And say, oh, well, I was going to have this meeting and I invited my building principal and he didn't show up, right? And here's the meeting invitation. So here again, telling the truth is always going to be best. IEP software that a lot of your school districts use, right? You can go back and look to see when a document like a meeting invitation was actually created. So if it was created after the date of the meeting and contemporaneous with the investigation where you're trying to lay the blame at somebody else's feet, well, that now says to me that you falsified documents. So on top of the other misconduct, you have that, you know, to add in.
I think the takeaway from this case is that, you know, falsifying information is bad.
Bad. Very bad.
Cutting corners is bad, but what is good is a quick response and training your staff for the future. So I think that this district took quick action, and in the future they trained their staff to know what's not acceptable for IEP meetings and what is expected.
Right, and I think in securing the resignation of this teacher, it kind of put the word out, right? Like you can't cut corners, this is not going to be an appropriate way to go. So if you do that, there's going to be a significant consequence.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
All right, so our last scenario that we wanted to talk about, we have a regular education student who assaults a classmate and is then suspended and expelled by the district.
Okay.
The district follows all of its standard discipline procedures with students who are just general education students, mm-hmm. right? No problem. The parent hires an attorney and files mm-hmm. a due process complaint. And the district is kind of scratching its head, right?
Because like, this is not a special education.
It's not a special education student, right?
Right.
So
yeah.
why do we have a due process complaint?
Yeah.
So in the due process complaint, the parent alleges that she had requested that her child be evaluated mm. a couple of months before.
A couple of months,
mm. right? So a while ago.
Mm, not good.
And as a result, this student was entitled to IDEA procedural safeguards when it came to discipline.
Yes.
And the district is going, we never got a request for an evaluation.
We don't know what you're talking about.
Right. So the district did what it should have done. It turned the matter over to insurance mm-hmm. and it contacted legal counsel. Mm-hmm. And as part of the review of all of the records that we needed to look at, we reviewed emails. And in reviewing the emails, lo and behold, we found an email that the parent had sent to the school psychologist and also to the school counselor mm. where she requested that her child be evaluated.
Mm.
In talking to these individuals, right? So the district is following up and they're talking to these individuals. Basically, the school psychologist is like, oh, I thought the counselor handled it.
Oh.
And the counselor's like, well, I thought the school psychologist handled it.
Sometimes that happens. Actually, that probably happens a lot where
uh-huh.
each person's like, oh, yeah, I thought this was her job. Oh, I thought this was her job.
Yeah.
You know?
So in the end, mm-hmm.
Nobody handled it.
The district, you know, from a due process standpoint,
yeah.
they ended up settling with the
of
parent.
Course.
Right? So
right.
I don't think anyone thinks that that's a big surprise. They ended up settling with the parent.
Yeah.
And then they ended up doing some additional training
sure.
With staff members involved. Both staff members received some discipline. But again, kind of like you said, it mm-hmm. it was easy to see how the mistake happened.
Yeah.
But somebody needed to be doing a better job of kind of being the point person for these types of requests.
And I think that applies also to other kinds of requests. I think that you know, not only evaluation requests get lost, but public records requests mm-hmm. get lost all the time. Educational records requests get lost. You know, a parent doesn't necessarily know to whom to address his question or her request, so they'll just send it to somebody, but that person might not know who is in charge of it. So they'll just send it to some, and then that person will just ignore it because they're like, oh, this is not my job. I don't even know why this email came to me. You know, I just do my job. So make sure, you know, that I think a big takeaway from this kind of case is make sure that your procedures for responding to parent requests, whether it relates to evaluations, educational records, a public records request from a community member, make sure it's very clear who those requests should be forwarded to, who is in charge, who is responsible, you know, and make sure you have protections in place to trigger a response within the correct time frame if that person is out, if that person is on leave. You know, you never want to be in a situation where you're like, oh, it was winter break, so I got this email a month later, you know, mm-hmm. like that. So
like an evaluation request over the summer can be particularly mm-hmm. problematic, right?
Yeah.
If your school district is not a year-round school district, mm-hmm. Then you can have a parent who literally is sending something in to, say, a school psychologist over the summer, and the school psychologist
isn't
working, right? Like after the middle of June. They're not back until sometime in late August.
Yeah.
So you've got to have procedures in place to figure out how we're going to handle these requests, whether they're coming in over the summer or whether it's something that's coming in during the course of the school year, and making sure that all of your staff members, you know, particularly those who might not always get these requests, like a general education classroom teacher, mm. you know, are aware of what does it sound like when a parent says, I would like my child to be evaluated, and then what do I do with that information? How do I carry it forward to make
important.
Sure that nothing falls through the cracks?
Yeah, I think that's important. I think, you know, in general, the message here is that mistakes are going to happen all the time. You know, we are all just human. Even though parents often expect school districts to be perfect, there are going to be mistakes. And the key issue is how those mistakes are immediately addressed and what lesson we learn from them for the future, to prevent anything in the future. So thank you. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for talking to us about mistakes and how they should be handled. I really appreciate it. And next time, we're going to be talking about another fascinating and exciting educational topic. In the meantime, while you're waiting, please rate us highly on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast, and send us fan mail. We love fan mail.
Fan mail's good.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for joining us, everyone.
The content of this podcast is provided for general information purposes only. The podcast is not legal advice, does not create an attorney-client relationship, and should not be relied upon in making legal decisions. Actions on legal matters should be taken only upon advice of legal counsel. Walter Haverfield does not guarantee the accuracy of information contained in this podcast.